Harry, Peter, Spike.
Do you remember when the Aeolian Hall? If you touched the microphone, you'd have 10 BBC officials
get
out. Leave that alone. That's BBC property, that. And yeah. There was a BBC plate.
Except all the pockmarks on it, didn't like.
Yes. Like you used by Tommy Henley and Ted Ray. Where from, John?
From the top, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, I now present to the Goon. I pronounce you, Burke. The Goon Show, open!
We've been together now for 40 years, and it ain't been a day.
Come in, folks! It was the kindest way out.
Thank you all.
And now for an encore, Mr. Webster Smogpule will sing that lovely Mongolian saxophone solo for Cor Anglais and Cor Blamey. I lost my teeth in a monastery garden by Hurlston.
Let me like a song. Oh, pardon me. Let me like us all again upon the field of battle.
We would like to announce that this was Smogpule's farewell appearance. But now to this week's great feature.
Chapter 1, 1939. I join the colours. No, put me down.
We met in North Africa, Spike and I. I mean, we were mates, a couple of army mates. We laughed at the same things. And when I came out of the army, it was a dodgy business, trying to get work. I was determined not to go back to the office I'd been in before the war, as a pay clerk in an office in Swansea. So I came up to London, did an audition at the Windmill Theatre, and got in. And Mike Benteen followed me into the Windmill Theatre. And I realised, this fella's got the same sort of thing as Spike and I've got. So I went down to see him in the dressing room.
And we had 3 and 6 months between us. So instead of eating anything, we went, to keep out of the rain, to the nearest Cameo cartoon theatre and stayed round about 5 times, falling about, screaming with laughter. And from then on, we've been mates, you know, completely. And then I was working with Harry doing Variety Bandbox, and I was writing him weird things. And the star of the show was Derek Roy, for whom Jimmy Grafton was writing. So he said, he wrote us a letter, and he said, our styles are clashing. Would you like to come down and talk it over with me? So we thought, ah, great. Then we saw the address, Grafton Arms, Strutton Ground, near Victoria Street. And we thought, it's a pub. He owns a pub. So, of course, we'd go anywhere for beer in those days.
That's what it means.
People who were in show business would get a drink there. That was the essential reason for us being there. And we somehow or other gravitated there. I wasn't a drinker. I used to play the piano while they all drank. I remember that quite clearly.
It was coming together. There was Spike and I started. Then I met Mike. So I introduced Spike to Mike.
And it grew. Anybody who played the Wimble went to Grafton's, which was Mike, Harry Secombe, Peter Sellers, Larry Stevens, who knew Harry from the Windmill, Tony Hancock, Alfie Marx, Graham Stark was a chum of Larry Stevens, and in the end, pretty well the whole of what was going to be show business for the next 15 years was upstairs at Grafton's. You've never seen anything like it. Young, mad enthusiastic and wild.
Remember, we were all ex-servicemen. That was a big bond in those days. I don't mean a jingoistic bond. It really was a bond of mutual suffering, because we'd all been through it.
All so earnest about this war, all so desperately killing each other. It's a Goon Show, isn't it, with blood?
It's war, W-A-R, pronounced...
war!
We, all of us, Mike Benteen, Harry, Spike and I, had this feeling that we had to do something. We had this thing inside us, this... we wanted to express ourselves in a sort of surrealistic form. We thought in cartoons, we thought in blackouts, we thought in sketches, we thought of mad characters, we thought of take a situation and instead of letting it end normally, let it end the other way, twist it around.
Mariate. Take a letter in gargling fluid. To the Postmaster General. Dear General, according to the shape of my knees, I believe that an illegal raffle for the equator is being held. And for certain monies, I will reveal the organizer. Let's have that back, please. You filthy swine. You've watered my peony.
Sometimes I'll read this to people at the pub, seeking out some kind of acceptance of the joke, because they were all as thick as planks. They're just boozers. They never laughed at anything. And I thought, why am I laughing at this and nobody else is? Primarily because they weren't funny and I was. And they have multiplied since to a greater degree. So much so they're writing comedies now with no laughs at all. Some little light in me said, ignore these stupid bastards. It is funny. You are funny. Enjoy it yourself. That was the driving energy behind me. And I've been like that ever since. That's why I'm now totally unemployed.
We had these sort of get-together, ad-lib bits and pieces of comedy that we all sort of chipped in with. Recorded them on this, and when it's set up on this old wire recorder.
Tape record it, quick!
And this grew and grew and grew and grew. And eventually, as you know, after knocking on the BBC door for months and months, Pat Dixon got us on.
Well, it came in via the back door. Peter Sellers knew Pat Dixon, who really was the enfant terrible of the BBC. He put on some very, very good shows. And he saw there was a potential in it.
Patrick McNeil Dixon, towering individualist who wouldn't be put down anybody.
All right, Pat, relax.
You relax, you blew the mic.
And he fought it through and eventually got it on.
5 on 9, slight pause, 12 and 13 on 20.
What there, seeker, please?
The BBC gave us a trial recording, a pilot show we did. Fortunately, it was a hit. And a series came out of that, which Dennis Mayne Wilson produced.
I suppose the BBC knows what it's doing.
When I produced the first series of The Goon Show, we weren't allowed to call it The Goon Show. We had to call it Crazy People, because the BBC thought that nobody would know who the goons were. To which I think Spike or Peter Sellers said, well, who are take it from here, then? No response.
The word goon had arisen in sort of different ways for each of us. I think we all caught it from Edgar Seegar's famous cartoon strip Popeye. You know, the goons were these what-no-type characters. A featureless face, huge hairy arms who spoke in soundtrack. And then during the war, I talked to a number of escaped prisoners of war. And they always referred to the German guards as the goons. The others had their own origins for goons, but we all recognised the word instantly and used it.
The first shows were appallingly unfunny, but absolutely highly charged with the promise of more electricity to come.
Good evening. Good evening, Captain. Glad to have you with us again.
Glad to have me with you,
Now tell me, Captain, is it true that you built the Suez Canal?
Oh, yes, Mr. Milligan, yes, oh, yes, I built it. It took me a long, long time, though. First, I had to get some permission from Cleopatra.
But the Cleopatra's been dead for 2,000 years.
I told you, it took me a long, long time.
What do you want, Fishpipe?
I sure am like him, Mr. Farouk. I'm building a canal, and I'm afraid it's going to run right through your house.
What? Do me a favor, yucky boy. You think I'm going to run downstairs and open the front door every time a ship wants to go through?
What? You silly old thing, you don't have to do that now. You can leave the key under the mat.
Mike was Captain Pureheart. Ah, one of those. Which is quite close to himself, as Daddy was close to me. And it sort of presaged what eventually happened with Neddy being a central character. He was going that way, I think.
Osric was a favourite of Spike's. He always loved it. They used to give me the posh voices, you see. They gave me the
hellos and the yes, and this is Hugh Jempton here, speaking to you from Kempton Park. And, you know, one of those.
This may be amusement to you, but it's bread and butter to us.
In the second series, we were getting better. We got a few more coconut shells. The scripts got better and better and more adventurous. And it was still very much a documentary format. And Spike, I suspect, felt confined. The script was being almost personality-led by Benteen.
Mike Benteen throws out ideas like sparks on a Catherine wheel, say. And Spike is... his mind flies away. And between them, they get together and expand on an idea. And perhaps at the end of the day, they both go home thinking the idea was theirs. Which sometimes led to a little bit of friction, because Spike would think it was his and Mike would think it was belonged to him.
Everybody being an individual, which is the right of everybody on the planet, sees it slightly differently. We all laugh at exactly the same things.
On we plunged, through raging snowstorms. 3 weeks we battled on, right to starvation.
Yes, many's the day we had to exist on a handful of caviar and champagne.
Yes, the weight of our baggage became too much. In a moment of desperation, we ditched the following vital equipment. 1,800 weight of rusty iron piping with fittings.
24 lead budgerigar perches.
One long, thin object with no fixed abode.
One bronze bicycle with cement parachute ejector seat.
One...
And bus.
36 cardboard replicas of Nelson's column from the inside.
One collapsible rubber mosque with detachable beard.
That's enough, men. We daren't risk leaving any more behind.
I mean, the humour that used to prostrate Spike and Harry also prostrated Pete and me, you know. McGonagall.
May I introduce myself, sir? I am William J. McGonagall, poet and tragedian and twit.
The nonsense novels of Stephen Leacock.
One line it was, something in the lad's upturned face appealed to him. He threw a brick at it. Now, that kind of thing.
Essentially, they were the basis of the sort of pricking of the balloon of pomposity was the thing that made us laugh.
Mike Benteen wanted to go into reality documentary and take the mickey out of the present state of the nation, quite technically. The rubber's an airliner.
If you will open the hangar door, you can see the huge Brabagoon airliner, a product of British genius. Start the engines! And you heard... and four trains left Waterloo Station. And there's a long pause, and then he says, Carstairs, that, yes, Professor Purehart? Would you mind asking the chief designer to step into my office for a moment? It was that sort of humour.
Spike wanted to take off and just disappear into, you know, jet-propelled secret naffies and things like this. And some he had to give.
Are you alive?
What, Captain?
After all that digging, you know, I mean, do you know what they want to do with my beautiful canal?
What?
Fill it with water!
Having been brought up as the son of a pioneer and a natural heretic and a natural radical, having seen a thing was becoming a success, I then wanted to get on with something else, which I then did.
I was myself veering towards writing a storyline away from these small, short sketches.
Spike in the studio lacks confidence in self. He said to me once, what I need then is a strong producer. It wasn't going to be me. I've tried it before. And there was a great drama producer, Peter Eaton.
He was firm with the lads, because sometimes we're a bit boisterous and over the top, and he'd tell us in no uncertain terms, service terms, to pack it in. And we would, because he had that kind of authority.
Very funny, yeah.
All right, let's have a rough run through, Blake.
He had a dramatic background. I think it was the Somme.
And he took over from the third series onwards and whacked discipline in. And the show took off.
Dawn, June the 9th was 0 hour. Inside the Albert Memorial rocket, we stood waiting Professor Seagorn's orders.
All ready?
Yes, sir.
Can I ride on top?
Why?
I want to smoke.
Silence, now close the hydraulic doors. Already on the doors. Stand by the spy thing, little bit flat. Eccles, what? Check the Yucca Macaga gauges. Flywheel, stand by the thermostatic gyroscope. Check the mercurial compression of the internal bithermics. Across the coordinate radar on the ultra. Release the afterstock burners. Raise the hydrostatic elements and hurl Lockheed Martin thermals from the metric depressions.
Do it yourself.
Mutiny! Eccles, arrest that man.
Okay, come on.
Take your dirty hand off my filthy arm.
What?
Yes, but it wasn't me.
No. Never mind. We're taking off in 10 seconds from now. Let's have a look at that list. Right. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Strange enough, I think the four of us, it was pretty unwieldy with four. When it was stripped down to three, it seemed to work better. I'm not demeaning what Mike's contribution, of course, but that's how it seemed to work out eventually.
Is this pre-recorded, this piano? It's all pre-recorded, is it?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's going bomb, 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 and we should be more spread out.
The rehearsals were hysterical because that was the time when it all came together. The first run-through would be hysterical, because we'd all be laughing and mucking about. And then when the band came in, you'd have a band rehearsal with the orchestra. Then it was a bit different, because you were getting near the nitty-gritty.
I'm in love with an old trombone.
The band was wonderful, and the music was exceptionally good now.
Angela Morley did all the writing for it. Very talented indeed.
My job was to write cues for the programme, whatever Spike wanted, and to write this arrangement for Max Gelder every week. And so I did that for about 2 years. Then one day Stanley Black said he didn't want to do it anymore. So I got that opportunity.
The links between were like Hollywood epics.
When I die, take all the treasures of my kingdom, place them at my feet, then bury me in some high, forgotten mountain.
There was a tremendous lift from the orchestra. The cruel sea type music we had. The music was witty. That was the thing about the music.
I'm going to clear my name and get back my self-respect.
Yep.
I'll join the Navy!
Why? It's too damn noisy in the Navy.
Well, Spike made his needs very plainly known. I mean, he described in the script every week, how he wanted it to be. And then, of course, when we got to rehearsal, Spike would sometimes say, no, 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 it sounds too good. I know in one show there had to be a national anthem for some Ruritanian sort of country in Middle Europe, you know. And I composed this national anthem. Then when Spike heard it, he said, no, that sounds much too good. He said, I just want to hear one instrument at a time. So it sort of kind of started with piccolo, and then it went to trombone, and then it went to violin or something. And he was absolutely right. It sounded fantastic. I'd like to think I composed it that way, you see.
No one has had the courage.
Obviously, when you started playing the scoring by Angela, there was something in it for everybody there. All the band felt as if they were really an important part of the show, which, of course, they were.
And the musicians in the band loved doing the show, you know. And sometimes they had little things to do, you know. The George Chisholm sometimes had a line or something. And the Poggy Pogson, who was one of the saxophones.
Ming, stop playing that saxophone in Africa and put it back in the fridge.
Sometimes he'd have a little violin thing, and Max occasionally had a line.
I know, boy, it's the old conk that gives me away.
Hello, I'm Max. It keeps the rain off your tie, mate.
Yeah. Max Geldre played the evergreens, and so did Ray Ellington. They played some modern tunes, but also the evergreens. So, strangely enough, the Goonship doesn't seem to date for that reason. We got a lift from it. There was a... Your foot was tapping all the time. We used to be in the wings, swigging down a bit of brandy that disguised as milk, waiting for the, hey! You've been a mouth organ, you know, a harmonica.
That's nice. God, blimey.
That is nice.
This is the BBC Home Service. Enter a short idiot.
Let me take this. In the beginning, the Goon Show was a series of unrelated sketches. Eventually, they decided, or Spike decided, that it would be a good idea to have a central figure around which these strange, bizarre incidents occurred. So my voice being the most distinctive, inasmuch as I couldn't disguise it when I did any other voice, I became Eddie Siegel, which is really only an extension of my own self, I suppose.
Have a care, sir. I'm not a man to be laughed at.
I know. I've seen your act. Singing shaver, isn't it?
I have my dark secrets.
Spike always saw me as a little idiot in ragged underpants running on. It worked then. I mean, you could do all these things as a story. Spike wrote the Goon Show then as a story rather than as a series of unrelated incidents.
Now, who can we interview first?
A long voice. Oh!
When Michael left, there was only two of them. And there was room for a third voice. And then, bit by bit, I didn't have much confidence in myself because I was pretty overwhelmed by the talents of Peter Sellers and things. But one thing he couldn't do was two voices at once. So, consequently, this third voice came into being.
Ah, now, who was that knocking?
It was my friend, Grit My Pain.
I can't see him.
That's because you are playing him.
What?
He's never here when you're here.
I don't understand.
Neither of the audience. That's why he isn't getting a laugh. Oh.
And so I used to just drop in voices. I think I invented Minnie Bannister because Henry Crane had no love life. So I tried to create a demonic sex goddess for him, Minnie Bannister.
Stop! Stop, stop. It's Spoonie's out of tune, Min. Have you been eating with it again?
No.
And what's that you're stirring the soup with?
A violin.
He's always got an answer to your card.
No.
And little Jim.
I can't read this rubbish. Oh!
It's Holland in the marker.
Moriarty. All the hangers-on. Yes. They were actually culled from real life.
I travel the road in a military way.
I was born in India, son of the Indian Army. And among the Indian Army were all the despotic majors and colonels that weren't allowed in England for feeling little girls' bicycle saddles. They'd been deported to India for this. They sold the regimental silver. They plundered the funds. They slept with all good-looking officers' wives.
All lies, do you hear me? Lies. I was in Bangalore at the time. I deny every word. She's lying, I tell you. Lying, and so is Alice Girth and Mary Sula and all the other women I'm molesting. They're all after my piggy bank, do you hear me?
That was Bloodnock. He was a real character and a swipe.
And now over to the British military advisor to the Abyssinian Girls' School in Addis Ababa.
Wait a minute. I haven't got my trousers on yet, please. Oh, that's better. Now. Blast these flies. Get out of it. Get out of it, you flies. Shum. Timanushua. Singes. Singes thing.
I am coming, sir.
Take these flies out and sell them.
All right. Come on, boys. Rex Rover. Come on, boys. How do you go now?
Now, having got that matter over, now to my private matters of the day. Dear madam, reference your advert in shop window. And well-known photography magazine. As a keen student of photography, I should like to...
Pardon me. There is a European fireman hiding in the waiting room. Sir.
What? Well, tell him to wait in the hiding room while I paste these photographs in my hat. Paste!
And we all saw each other. I mean, I saw Spike as Eccles.
I'm the anti-climax.
I think Eccles is haunted by Goofy. Childhood love of my life is Goofy. I slightly refined him and made him more into Homo sapiens on a very low key, you know. He represented the loser in life, who always came up smiling out of every occasion and could not be defeated by logic. He can always overcome it. Like you ask him for the time, and he'd say, I've got it written down in a piece of paper here. Things like that. And if you say, it's not that, your bit of paper must be faster than mine. Strange, insane. It's a child's logic, isn't it? After children's logic.
Is it, Eccles?
Just a minute. I got it written down here on a piece of paper. A nice man wrote the time down for me this morning.
Oh. Then why do you carry it around with you, Eccles?
Well, if anybody asked me the time... I can show it to them.
Wait a minute, Eccles, my good man.
What is it, fellow?
It's written on this bit of paper. What is 8 o'clock, is written.
I know that, my good fellow. That's right. When I asked a fellow to write it down, it was 8 o'clock.
Well, then... supposing when somebody asks you the time, it isn't 8 o'clock.
Well, then I don't show it to them.
Ah. Yeah. Well, how do you know when it's 8 o'clock?
I got it written down on a piece of paper.
I wish I could afford a piece of paper with a time written on.
Oh.
Here, Echo.
Yeah?
Let me hold that piece of paper to my ear, would you? Here. This piece of paper ain't going.
What? I've been told a forgery.
No wonder it stopped at 8 o'clock.
Oh, dear.
You should get one of them things my granddad's got.
Oh?
His firm gave it to him when he retired.
Oh.
It's one of them things, what it is, that wakes you up at 8 o'clock, boils the kettle, and pours a cup of tea.
Oh, yeah. What's it called?
My grandma.
Wait a minute. How does she know when it's 8 o'clock?
She got it written down on a piece of paper.
The marvellous thing was to stand next to Peter when he was doing Gritpipe, because he became Gritpipe.
Any more left?
Only this £50,000 in loose silver.
Oh. Now, where can I hide that? I've got it. Moriarty, say ah. Now, Moriarty, keep your mouth shut. I don't want... Army Pay Corps here. Chief Cashier speaking. Yes? What? Moriarty!
Physically, he changed. Quite remarkable.
Harry and I were, we just got out of the taxi and were going into the stage door of the Chiswick Empire. When out of the shadows, it was raining, came a 6'2" man with a red beard, long red beard, and a scoutmaster's outfit, quite a young man, with a racing bicycle. And he said, "Hello, I want to be a coon." And I thought, God almighty, it's too tall for Spike. And Harry said, "It's Peter's fatter than that. It can't be Pete." And we realized he was for real. And I said, "You want to be a coon? I want to be a coon for the coon show. I like the coon show. He's a lovely bloke." So I said, "Well, it's not really up to us. You'll have to go over to Finsbury Park Empire. I'm sorry it's raining." He said, "No, that's all right. I can ride in the rain." And I said, "Well, you go over there and you talk to Peter and you say that I think you're a genius." "Yes, I will. I will," he said. "Yes." He practically said, "My captain," and went roaring off into this howling gale. And apparently he turned up about an hour and a half later because it's right across London.
Anyway, the door opened and the fellow said, "There's some stranger, a geezer out here." "Well, I don't know what he says." Michael Bentley sent him along, so I thought, "Well, I might as well see him, you see." So, anyway, this tall fellow, he got a little briefcase and he got a scout hat, but he got a big red beard with all this, and red knees and socks and all the insignia, you know. And he said, and I'm not kidding, this is how he spoke, he said, "Could I come in for a moment, please?" No. And I thought, what is this? Is it? So I said, "Yes, certainly, please. What can I do for you?" He said, "Maka, I have just seen Maka Benteen at Chiswick, and he said that I'm a genius."
And so he found out who was.
"Men, halt! Our duty is to crush vice in Finchley. Crush your vice and leave just enough for us."
Gritpipe Tin was all the very cool Englishmen I'd ever known, who basically had the arse out of their trousers. No, they were poorer. They had the arse out of somebody else's trousers.
"Please, Moriarty. Keep still. Do you want us both out of this suit?" "Ah."
And they're always talking in big terms of money and all this. And I remember seeing them in my journeys through the world. I was sitting next to a man in a first-class seat on a British Airways plane, and he was talking in millions of pounds to me.
"One of our inmates is heir to £1,000,000.
Oh. Oh, £1,000,000. Oh, money.
And I noticed that all his cuffs were heavily frayed and that one of his cufflinks was a piece of string knotted to hold the shirt together. But he talked in millions of pounds like this. And then when he crossed his legs, I noticed an enormous hole in his sock with blackened skin underneath, which proclaimed he hadn't had a bath for a long time for a start. But he still talked in million until we landed, yes. I think he left money owing to the cabin crew. I paid all the failures, all the characters that really had no hope, like Moriarty had no hope at all.
Meantime, from the comparative safety of a long-disused factory chimney, a French Scrag reviews his financial position.
"Well, I'm an empty tin. One fishbone elegant. One house big for me down. Piece of string.
Hello. So, you've been keeping these things from me, eh? Now, put all that stuff in my name at once."
"I'm sorry, Gritpipe."
Well, his teeth were kept in a locked tin by Gritpipe Thin.
"I have my teeth back for Christmas."
"Here is the pawn ticket."
"You pawned my teeth? You're a spy of a spy."
"What?
I challenge you to a duel. Name your weapon."
"Teeth."
"I've lost."
Wasn't allowed to eat until he went out and got money or something like that. It was a release when I heard it actually performed, because the rehearsals many, many times far eclipsed the actual show for hilarity. Because when the boys heard the joke for the first time, they were very tempered to laugh instantaneously in a sort of a really hysterical way, a deep enjoyment of the joke.
I am with Captain Goat Cabin's Balancing Stallions. And I'm also with Miss Golden Finish. Late Dr. Eve's Golden Finish. That's the one I wanted to tell
what
you. I'm going to finish you off.
There is a war between the Japanese army in a tree in the back of a lorry who are being fired at through the aperture in the driver's cab between the English army. That's all I know. And they're driving along having this war in a three-ton lorry. I thought that was hysterically funny.
Bad luck! Stop the lorry! Those Japs are firing at us!
The treacherous devils! Help me off with me, Judge.
No, Major, please! Not Leo the Lion! Please, yes. Not that again! They know the tattered leg trick now.
Well, there you are. It's done the trick. They've stopped firing.
Yes! I've run out of ammunition.
What? Well, there's no dice here. You've had enough on tick from us already.
Wait a minute. Please tell me, how much we owe?
Sigun, play him back his account.
Right, sir. And sixpence halfpenny.
Please, Billy, please. I promise I pay you back at the rate of... a week.
Sigun, how much is... in English money?
It's about... Sir.
It's not enough, do you hear? Here, hold me trousers.
No!
Get him out of that tree with the wristwatch. The treacherous devils. They've found more ammunition. They must have had a Red Cross parcel from home.
Cab. It's bulletproof.
Splendid. We can drive on and continue engaging the enemy in that tree in the back of the lorry all at the same time.
A magnificent exposition of the plot, Bloodlock.
Thank you.
And under enemy fire, too.
Of course.
Have a knighthood.
Oh, tar, mate.
Right then. Drive on, Sir Dennis.
Beep, a beep.
It was magic to hear that suddenly exploding around your ears. It's like Beethoven must have felt when he wrote the fifth round and then heard it played. But then he had to go and write the sixth and the seventh and so on. There's no let up. It was terrible, terrible strain.
You know, that this constant search for something different every week really got to him, and as you know, he's a manic depressive.
My personality made me want to write a better one each time, and I almost succeeded in doing that, actually improving the quality of the shows. It was a sort of strange insanity. It was my place in heaven I was trying to fight for. That's what it was. I couldn't stop it, you know. There was nothing I could do with it. I had to write it like I was preordained.
The mental pressure of turning out a show a week like The Goons must have been tremendous. And, you know, Spike couldn't always stand it. And therefore he had to occasionally call in help. Sometimes he brought in an assistant writer. But there were occasions when, because the show was scheduled and had to go out, that the script, in fact, was by somebody else. Well, that they are merely the indications of the times when Spike was particularly exhausted.
It was essentially Spike's show towards the end. It was just him writing it. Larry Stevens did some very good things. Eric did some good scripts. But eventually it was all down to Spike.
I think that Bernard Shaw would have balked at accepting a contract where he had to write 26 half-hour stories a year. But when you think of it, if you wanted to persecute somebody, you'd say, I sentence you to write 26 funny half-hours a year. Some believe it's overwhelming. It destroyed me. It destroyed me completely. So it wasn't a happy occasion. There used to be a feeling of relief on Sunday if it went well. But then you just went home, went to sleep and got up on Monday and started again. It was, in the words of Justice, totally unfair to do it to a human being. But that's how the cards were played. That was the set number that they had to have on BBC scheduling. It was 26 half hours. Six would have been enough. Might have lasted longer.
There were one or two Goon shows, or two or three Goon shows, where he wasn't able to perform. He wrote the script and he wasn't able to perform, so Peter and I did them. And then when we were ill or somebody was ill, then as we say, either Dick Emery or Graham Stark came in and did something.
When Spike got these sort of sad depressions and occasionally couldn't work, I was called in by Peter Eaton, who was then the producer of the show, and I depped, which was in a way a great honour, I depped for Spike, alternating with Dick Emery. In other words, say there were six shows that Spike couldn't do, I would do every other one and Dick would do the other one. So we would do three each.
It sounds naughty.
It is.
And there's Ma, where that came from.
He's marvellous at concocting these wonderful... He'd have Big Ben shamming like a cockerel, you know, or like a chicken. Marvellous team of lads they had in the control room, working the sound effects.
Phone.
I think the effects of the show got a great reputation. This was because at this time most of the recorded effects were on 78 discs.
They used to have Knock on Door and Footsteps on Gravel, which was the limit of the BBC sound archive. We wanted a Wurlitzer organ playing Changing Gear and Changing Key at the same time. Which is a wonderful idea and sounded very funny when it was actually done.
Get in, buddy.
Okay, buddy, get that.
Okay, crazy.
This is pre-tape days. So if you had an effect sequence, you were going to have to play the records and very often play them live into the show. That meant you'd had a turntables with about six records on, and you've got to play these in sequence and time them to go in cohorts with the cast using what has been recorded and it exists in the library. Though very often, of course, you're using effects that have been recorded in a totally different context.
Oh, we just asked for them, and I think it gave the... It certainly woke them up backstage, like one to the sound of a wall going at speed.
Hey! That tricep against the wall. Whose is it?
Mine. A present from an admirer.
Could you drive me to town on it?
Oh, the tricycle isn't mine. The wall was the present.
Drive me there on that.
Right. Hold tight.
The sound you are hearing is Neddy and Eccles driving a wall at speed. We thought you ought to know.
Pianos drawn by a gaggle of chickens.
Can you start feeding in the tuning with the piano with a chicken... After line 9.
And an oyster.
Fred the Oyster, which is a donkey braying and breaking wind at the end of it.
Yeah, why shouldn't an oyster be German?
Because an oyster can't talk.
Have you ever spoken to one?
No.
Ah. Then you don't know, do you?
No.
Yeah. Now, look, we've got an oyster here.
Fred, isn't it?
Yes. Put it on the desk. There you are, Min. There. Now, go and speak to it.
Good morning. This is madness. You can't.
You'll have to speak louder. He can't hear you.
Of course not. The oyster's closed.
Closed? Wednesday, of course. It's early closed. Shout loud to it. Shout loud.
Shout
loud.
Good morning!
They were mules. I remember These mules used to do this to cool their lips in India. They'd blow some unbelievable raspberries. They used to collapse me. They still do. They still paralyze me. Whatever that happened, I was helpless. The thought of it is unbelievable. The mule was doing it, not knowing how funny it was.
Yeah, we want. I tell you what, can that come in full volume? You know, belt it right out. Oh, and a bit more than that.
Actually, it's the bigger one. There's one before that. There's one that,
before
which is
that,
louder.
Which is a real.
That's when they put the afterburner on. That one.
Yes, it's a real. Get the afterburn. Yes, naughty Neddy. Naughty Neddy. Naughty Neddy.
They did some brilliant things, and it was all the sound effects boys were probably the hardest worked sound effect boys that ever were, but they loved it. They really loved it because they had something to do besides open and close the door. The effect of the effects was something that is lacking today. I think in radio, what is lacking is that they're not creating pictures. You are transported. Now, that is what radio is good at, and the Goon Show did it.
There was one that one show I liked very much was without an audience. It was an experimental thing. The Starlings, which is done up in Newcastle, without an audience, done as a play, almost. I liked that. I think that was a good idea.
And with that, the herald sound the Thirk voluntary, the voluntary so well beloved by the Swahili Dust Group of Westminster. And now she reaches the great gold and bronze microphone to make her declaration. But first, the master of the rolls and leather goods pledges his allegiance, also the Quanta Donorum. So let us listen to it.
My lord, lady, and
he appears to be having trouble with the great microphone of state. The same great microphone used ever since 1672, hand-beaten and foot-slapped gold and silver, surmounted by two Burmese cherubs, and fashioned by the great sculptor Benvenuto Cellini and his brother Fred. Oh, and now I see the great engineer of state with the great state screwdriver adjusting the mace screws on the great microphone.
Funny show and exceedingly well done, and I think it should have been put up for the Italia Grand Prix. It should have been put up for it, because the comedy is no heroes really when it comes to bureaucracy.
Spike goes on about the BBC hating. He hates the BBC to this very day, he says. I don't really believe he does.
It's a mother machine, the BBC, isn't it? It's full of milk and everyone's got a teat.
There's no outfit in the world, even today, faced with a brand new product by a few crazy kids who not only would have kept it on, but kept pushing it and let it run, what, the 9, 10 series, was it?
There were people, I mean, there's a story, which Peter Eaton said was true, was at a planning meeting, somebody, one of the senior producers, got up and said, this go-on show, what's it all about? Who are these go-ons? Now, that was typical of a certain echelon at the BBC, where they weren't fully aware of what they were doing, what we were doing.
Dear heavily blotter-outer of...
Do it again.
Oh, really?
I'll give you the cue in.
You're going to read it again, folks.
I'll set this wardrobe on you.
Dear heavy blotterata of landscapes.
Well done.
It's the brandy, you know.
Achai and ahoy, Veyman. It's a warm brach mulech lecht for the shidduch, the new one.
And bless old Gala, too.
Folks, I don't know how I get these parts. I just don't know.
What about me, boy? They got me down as a Chinese.
Man, you won't get away with it. Pop, bubble, 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 with the pink champagne. Everything was safe and sane till the waiter poured the cork at the stork and pop, bubble, 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 with the pink champagne. He began to pour, I began to soar, more and more and more. Oh, that pink, pink feeling, as I went reeling to war remorse. Did I really fly through the ceiling? And did I ride home on my milkman's pink horse? Pop, bubble, 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 where's my aching brain? I am down to earth again. Elephants are at the sink. Oh, so pink. Pop, bubble, 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 take a Broma seltzer plane. Think I'm gonna die. Why did I ever try? Pink champagne. Bubble, 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 goes my aching brain. I am down to earth again. Elephants are at the sink, all so pink. Pop, bubble, 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 take a Broma seltzer plane. Think I'm gonna die. Why did I ever try? Pink champagne.
Ray Ellington, the demon plasterer, but then you'll have guessed.
Nothing was ever taken seriously, not even the announcements.
When I announced...
Send line, would you?
When I announced the first Goon Show in a field off Tiverton, I was 30. I am now 93.
Tim Timothy. Marvellous. He was the epitome of the BBC announcer. He looked at it, he wore a monocle, and he stood there with this disdainful expression, which is perfect for us. And then he left. And then Wally Greenslade.
I shall hurry through to the fin of wages. Part...
Do you mind?
Do you mind? I'll make this announcement.
Thank you, Walt.
The Fear of Wages, part two. The same day, 4 hours later.
Next, naval man. He was a big, jolly man. And he was wonderful. We used to send him up Rotten. Especially when we were doing the straight announcements, you know, in Pinch's bottom and things. I think Spike took a liking to him and to the character.
Well, that was quite wonderful. They had a duologue between John Snag and Greenslade. Yeah, I stood on the side of the wings and I laughed very much at these two straight men carrying out this conversation.
Now, look here, Wallace. There's a rumour going around the corporation that you're thinking of leaving.
Well, John, I have been getting offers.
But, Wallace, you're not going to leave us. Remember, you're British.
Dear John, what can I say?
What's the matter, Wallace? Aren't you happy with us? Isn't £3.10 a week enough?
Not quite, John.
But man alive, you have a free copy of the Radio Times every week.
It was great. Old Wally, he was good fun to be with. By the time the last Goon Show of all came round, Wally Greenslade had died, so Andrew Timothy came back for me.
Not loud enough. Not loud enough. We need bags of loud on the
CR. We can't hear the...
PA is down.
The PA is down. Like it was 28 years ago.
28 years ago, PA is down.
It's all right. Nothing has changed. Only the underwear.
Yes. And every what?
Okay, should be able to hear now.
Coming up.
What do you say?
Andrew's line. I'll do Andrew's.
By the way, that what's the recipe today, Jim? Should be so slow and should be.
What's the recipe today?
Like that, you know.
Felt a bit strange for the first 5 or 10 minutes, and after that was great, just as if nothing had happened.
What's the recipe today, Jim?
Have you tried Broadcasting House?
Every window.
Look, this is getting ridiculous.
Ned, Your Majesty, don't worry.
Why are you dressed like Bloodnock?
Oh, it's thin, isn't it?
Yes.
Hang on.
This is getting...
Ned, Your Majesty, don't worry.
Why are you dressed like Bloodnock?
Aren't we all?
We can cut those footsteps out, too. Right. And follow those footsteps. He just says your good news, Your Majesty, right?
Yes, carries on.
All right, just straighten, aren't they all? Now,
good news, Your Majesty. We have just found Goonshow 163, in which you play the lead all the way through as an underfloor heating detective.
I've always wanted big parts.
You've always had them, Neddy. You and Benteen.
Just get under the floor barge, Neddy.
There.
No. It's got to be hurried on record. Right?
Like the...
Okay, then.
Remember the Chinese thousand suit knocking on the door? Brrr.
On arrival at the tea house, as instructed, I knocked 6,000 times. House of the August gloom?
No.
Curse! It's next door. It's always next door in China. Yes. Tea house of August Goon?
Yes, huh?
Are you up on?
Yes, we are up on till 11 o'clock.
I think Eccles be working on a sewage farm at the moment. Bloodnock is possibly in a home for retired officers, working the bar.
Now, let me see, men. Yes, I'll pay pontoons only. Let's be having you now. Come along. Never mind, lad.
Not for me, sir. Skint.
No money?
No.
Grapple me, Gronkus. Get outside on guard. Military fool.
Moriarty has been dead 20 years, but nobody will tell him.
Oh, no.
Bluebottle is now the Prime Minister of England.
I heard you call me my capitaine.
Bannister, I don't know.
Sorry, Henry.
Possibly working as a housekeeper for Princess Diana.
Someday I'll find you, moonlight behind you, turn to the dream I am dreaming.
Henry Crun is trying to die.
Your smile.
Gritpipe Thin, or somebody like him, must be running the economy, doing the poll tax.
Of the 10,000 tenders, I have given the contract to F. Bog and Company.
Isn't that your wife's brother?
Thank you, Gritpipe. Here is your OBE and Lord Taverner's tie, the badge of success.
Sir! It was all a plot, you fiendish...
Yes, and there's no need to reiterate it. The audience saw this coming a mile off, didn't you?
Of course you did. Now, wasn't that lovely? Yes, and this is the end of the all-leather organ recital, save for one final ow.
Ow.
Lovely. Now the collection, please. Thanks very much. Thank you. Isn't it lovely? Good night.
It's all in the mind, you know.
It's plunged me into mental home after mental home. Funny on the back of all that, that there should be laughter. Strange chemistry, isn't it?
Strange chemistry, really, when we consider we're entirely different people, different kind of people. It's like Tom and Jerry cartoon. Tom gets bashed and becomes a concertina and thing. But in the next frame, he's whole. That was the way that we did. We blew bottles all being deaded, you know, blown up. So you couldn't do that on the screen. It had to be in the mind. And it was, as we used to say, it's all in the mind. And that's what the Goon Show was, all in the mind.
We used to pack so much energy into the show. And all our ideas and thoughts went into the show. Everything we had, we were just so keen to get it, to let people hear what was going on in our minds. This crazy, sort of strange fantasy that used to take place in our minds.
It's amazing because people have read into the Goon Show far more than there was. It was the product of a number of minds, of youngsters, all had a similar experience of the appalling things in war. But it was that hatred of pomposity. So when they started the idea, what do we want you to do? We all went, oh yes. We were heretics.
It wasn't the age of the hype. We never had T-shirts or mugs or paraphernalia from the exploiting. Totally unexploited, but it made it very pure in a way. It made it unsullied by commerciality. So it remains a very pure and dedicated show. And I think, without sounding too egotistical, it will just last as long as the tapes last.
That was At Last the Go On Show, a BBC recorded programme with Peter Sellers, Harry Secombe, Spike Milligan and Michael Benty. And the voices of Eric Sykes, Graham Stark, George Chisholm, Dennis Mayne Wilson, John Browell, Angela Morley and Charles Chilton. The music was by Angela Morley, Max Gildray and Ray Ellington. The scripts were by Spike Milligan, Eric Sykes, Larry Stevens, Michael Benteen and Maurice Wiltshire. The programme was researched and compiled by Michael Poynton, Ted Kendall and the producer, Dirk Mads.
Ladies and gentlemen, the recording is all right, so good night to you all, and thank you very much for coming along. Good night. Good night.
Now, get out!